Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Last week, my guest was Congressman John Katko, who represents New York's 24th Congressional District. This week, I'm joined by the woman who is pursuing a rematch with him this November, Democrat Dana Balter. In 2018, Ms. Balter lost a close election to the incumbent. This time around, she's also facing Francis Knoll in the Democratic primary. The 24th District includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties, and the western portion of Oswego County. Dana, I want to thank you for making the time for this conversation, and I hope that you've been well.
I have been, and thanks for having me, Grant. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's always good to have you on. So let's just start with the basics. Briefly, what have you been up to since November of 2018?
Well, believe it or not, mostly what I've been up to is campaigning as a congressional candidate, because as you know, our election cycles get longer and longer, our campaigns get longer and longer with every passing year. So we actually launched the current campaign for 2020 way back in April of 2019. Not all that long after the election. In between, of course, I took a little bit of time to rest and recoup from a very busy, very tough fought election campaign. And I spent a good deal of time reflecting on that election and thinking about, what we still needed to do here across the 24th district to bring the kind of change that we were fighting for. I also started a local nonprofit organization called Enter the Public Square to focus on building civic engagement, because one of the things that I heard consistently from people as I campaigned across the district is that while they really wanted things to be different, they weren't sure what they as individuals could do to make them different. And so we started offering some civic engagement skill building workshops in the community to adults and to kids. And I think that, I've talked on the campaign trail before about how desperately we need a revitalization of civics education in this country. And that's something I'm even more convinced now that I really want to fight for in Congress, a federal national initiative to bring civics back to our schools and to promote civic engagement opportunities for adults in our communities across the country.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And then, again, as a candidate starting up the election, obviously there's preparation time that goes into that, but most of what I have spent my time doing over the last year plus, I guess we're a year and a month in now, is traveling across the district before COVID-19 stopped our travel, of course, and, staying engaged with voters, meeting people in communities across the 24th and listening to their stories and in particular, talking to them about how things that have happened since the last election are affecting them. I'm sure we'll get into some of those issues later, but I've been hearing an awful lot about the tax bill of 2017 and the effects of that on folks across the district. So that's what I spend most of my time doing.
Okay, well, let's look at the incumbent that you're hoping to run against again this November, John Katko. And let's look at this recent term of Congress. What are the most important votes or actions that he has taken in this term that you would have acted differently on?
Yeah, so I'm going to take a moment to just predate this term and mention the tax bill that I just mentioned.
Okay.
That was in 2017, but last year was the first year that people had filed their taxes under that new tax law. And so it was the beginning of everybody seeing the effects of that tax law on their households and their bank accounts. And I cannot tell you the number of stories, the day after tax filing, I started getting phone calls from people all across the district telling me, you know, what happened to my $4,000 tax cut that my congressman promised me? Our taxes went up by $3,000. I talked to an 85-year-old woman who was surprised by the tax bill she got at the end of the year, and it left her with $10 in her savings account after she'd paid it. I know an older couple who had to clean out three savings accounts to pay their tax bill that year. And those are just a handful of the stories that I've heard. So I think that vote, although it was not this session, is very problematic for Central and Western New Yorkers. And I think people are really, really angry about it. It was a huge, a very bad decision on the part of Congressman Katko. And our families across the district were really feeling the impact of that before the COVID crisis began. More recently, you know, we've seen him do some extraordinary things. He voted against equal pay for women. He voted against raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. He voted against extending the deadline for the ERA. He confirmed his opposition to universal background checks for guns, which is something that's supported by 97% of Americans. He's pretty consistently showing us that he's on the wrong side of a lot of issues. And one of the things he did this year that I think is really extraordinary wasn't even a vote. And that was his coming forward with a full-throated endorsement of Donald Trump for 2020. And in that endorsement, Congressman Katko told us we're better off now than we were 3 years ago, which in and of itself is an extraordinary statement to me. And he insisted that Donald Trump's leadership is what we need for the next 4 years. That, to me, shows an extraordinary lack of judgment and really an unwillingness to be on the side of Central and Western New Yorkers, because Donald Trump and his administration are making us less safe, less healthy, less prosperous, less secure with every passing day. And the notion that our congressman supports that and supports this president is extraordinary to me. And, is just one more reason why he shouldn't be in that seat.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Democratic congressional candidate Dana Balter. Well, let's also stick with the incumbent and look more recently at COVID. The congressman has been very active, I think, during the response to COVID, at least based on the press releases and the media accounts. So how would you characterize the effectiveness of the actions and the initiatives that he's taken during this crisis?
Well, I think to some degree we have to wait and see, at least on some of these things that he's talking about, because, you know, we can't judge the effectiveness until something is in place and we see how it works. I will say I do appreciate that he has been more of a presence over the last couple of months. We've been asking the congressman for all the years that he's been in office to show up, to engage in community dialogue, to do town halls, to be responsive to constituents, and he's pretty steadfastly refused those requests. So it is nice to see a little bit more of him. I hope that, you know, that's something that continues. I will say, in terms of policy and substantive response to the COVID crisis, there are a couple things that we've seen from him that are extremely concerning to me. One, the most recent, is that he voted against the HEROES Act, this most recent relief bill. And that was really surprising to me, because the Heroes Act contains so many things in it that Central and Western New York desperately need. I would say chief among those items was significant aid to state and local governments, which we know are suffering tremendously and are having to cut services. And if you look in our district, a place like the city of Syracuse, which already was facing financial difficulty, and now due to the COVID crisis, so many of their sources of revenue have essentially dried up. And the harmful cuts that were headed our way made the need for that kind of aid from the federal government really significant. I believe the Post Standard said that Syracuse is set to receive about $375 million in aid if the Heroes Act passes the Senate. And it's amazing to me that John Katko voted against that. It expands aid for farmers, which is desperately needed. It invests money in rural broadband, which is desperately needed. And it extends another relief payment directly to households and individuals, which people desperately need. As we know, almost 40 million people have lost their jobs. And Congressman Katko, in his statement about that bill before he cast his vote, decided to use what I think really are Trump's tricks. He, in his statement, weaponized fear and partisanship as an excuse to stand in the way of that much needed relief for our region. And I was really very surprised to see that. And, you know, I will note, I agreed with Mayor Walsh of Syracuse in coverage about that bill and the congressman's vote when he said it's a shame, I'm paraphrasing here, he said it's a shame that partisanship and politics has to get in the way of this kind of bill.
Well, you go ahead and finish that, and then maybe after the break I'll ask you the question I wanted to ask, because I wanted to give you my version of what I heard the congressman say about this last week, but go ahead and finish your thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only other thing that I would say is this goes back to his endorsement of Donald Trump. What we've been seeing for months is that Donald Trump has made this crisis worse than it otherwise needed to be. The New York Times just recently published a story, or a report rather, of a study that looked at how many deaths could have been avoided, how many coronavirus deaths could have been avoided had we taken action a week earlier, or had we taken action 2 weeks earlier. And the results of that are shocking. We're talking about 60,000 Americans who have died, who did not need to die. Donald Trump and his administration knew about this virus, knew what it was, knew that it was coming. They had a plan left to them by the previous administration. They had everything in place they needed to take swift, decisive action to protect Americans. And instead, Donald Trump lied about this virus. He shifted attention from this virus. He undermined the efforts of the experts to do something about this virus. And he continues to lie to us about it. He continues to undermine expertise. We still, more than 2 months in, don't have a national plan for testing, which is imperative if we are going to get this under control. And the fact, again, that our congressman endorses this man and has said nothing about his handling of this virus, that to me is a real failure of leadership.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dana Balter. She's looking to unseat Republican Congressman John Katko in the 24th District this November, and is also running in the Democratic primary against Francis Knoll. So I wanted to come back to your discussion of the incumbent John Katko's vote against the Heroes Act. It was a very partisan vote. I believe it had no Democrats and no Republicans crossing the party lines on this. When I asked him about this last week, and I'm paraphrasing here, but basically his response was, well, it was in contrast to the other COVID bills, it was extremely partisan in the way it was drawn up and that there wasn't any Republican involvement, A. And B, it was clearly not dead on arrival in the Senate. And it had some things in it, and I won't get into this, that aspects of it that he didn't like. But he did like some of the things that you mentioned that were important about it. So here now, I'm extrapolating my own impression, was that my sense of this then was that there's probably an expectation that there will be some kind of compromise bill that is going to come out of this, that the Senate and the House will hopefully be able to work out. And I imagine on that one, he will vote for it. So it's one of these issues where there's a lot of different things in the bill and the way it was done. I don't know if there's a question there, but is there? Do you have some kind of response to sort of that way of organizing one's decision? Because if you win and you're in office, you're gonna be faced with this all the time, where bills have one thing you like and three things you don't like, and so on. So how does that change the calculation in your view, if at all?
Well, I think you're right that particularly when you're talking about a big bill like this, right, we're talking about massive spending bills, there is no way that you're going to agree with 100% of what's in that bill, right? And no bill is perfect. And I would say that about every relief bill that has been passed, right? This is the fourth that the House has passed. I don't think any one of them was perfect. But you can't wait for perfection. Right? You have to look at the bill in its entirety. You have to look at the circumstances that we're trying to address, which right now are urgent beyond belief. Again, almost 40 million people have lost their jobs. People are struggling and suffering. Entire communities are struggling and suffering, and we've got to get relief to them. It is taking too long. The vast majority of what's in that bill is good for the American people. And thanks to the focus that Democrats have insisted on over this entire series of bills, we are really seeing policy that's designed first and foremost to help hardworking families and households. And that is what we desperately need right now. I think that politicizing, and when I say politicizing, I should be more specific, because all of this is political, and I don't want to confuse politics with partisanship. Making this a partisan game is a huge mistake, and it, as far as I'm concerned, is a failure of the American people for our leaders to do that. This is too important. And we need our representatives to put the partisan nonsense, the partisan gamesmanship aside and just do what's best for the people. And right now, that bill is it.
Do you think very quickly, because I want to move on to another topic, but very quickly, do you think that Speaker Pelosi should have involved Republicans on this one in the way that she did in earlier ones?
Well, you know, it's really interesting to hear that that's a complaint. That's not something that I had heard the congressman say before. But one of the conversations I've been watching play out is all of this criticism that Speaker Pelosi is getting from Republicans in the House over rule changes about voting and hearings and being able to do work remotely. She's getting criticism for trying to allow Congress to work remotely so that they can actually all participate in these processes and get the work done without meeting together in person and putting each other and then in turn their communities at risk. So on the one hand, the Republican Party is criticizing her for that effort, and on the other hand, demanding more participation and input. Those two things are in direct opposition to each other. So, you know, they've got to pick their poison. And decide, do they want to work together as a Congress to do what's right for the American people, or do they want to bicker and launch partisan attacks? They're free to do either. I know what I expect from my elected representatives. I've been waiting a long time for them to step up and do it. So it's part of the reason why I'm running.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Democratic congressional candidate Dana Balter. With the time we have left now, I want to pivot to the primary and look at some of the differences between you and the other candidate, Francis Knoll. It's a complicated primary. It's being held on June 23rd, but it's got early voting at selected locations from June 13th to June 21st, and then it has a mail-in component that is going on now. And so you've got this one opponent, Francis Knoll. He appeared on this program in March, and our listeners can find that interview on the Campbell Conversations webpage at wrvo.org. Let me just start briefly, if you could. What are the most important policy differences, if there are any, between you and Mr. Knoll?
I'm not able to answer that question fully because I am not 100% clear on Mr. Knoll's policy stances in most areas. One area where I know we have a distinct difference is on healthcare, where I have heard him say that his view of healthcare is that we should strengthen the ACA and add a public option and stop there. And as you know from our previous conversations, I believe that doesn't solve our healthcare problem. We need to go further than that and make sure that we're extending coverage to every single American. And I believe we do that by giving everybody access to Medicare. Beyond that, I can't really articulate clear differences because it's not clear to me exactly where he stands on the issues. So, you know, what I can do is tell you where I stand and the things that I'm fighting for, in addition to making sure that every American has access to medical care. I'm hoping to work in Congress on building a fair economy for everybody so that everyone has opportunity, meaning the minimum wage should be a living wage, meaning we need strong worker protections. We need good transportation and childcare options so that people can get to work and can take jobs because they know their children are well cared for. We need a tax system that doesn't favor the wealthy and giant corporations the way that John Katko and Donald Trump think it should be structured, and instead puts the needs of hardworking families and seniors and veterans and students and people with disabilities first. And I keep saying my number one legislative priority is to get big money out of politics because it's a corrupting influence in our system. And it leads us to representatives like John Katko taking millions of dollars from corporate PACs and voting in their interests instead of in ours.
Well, let me interject because we only have a few minutes left, and I do want to get some more questions in about the primary that's coming
sure.
up. So let me bring it back to Francis Knoll, if I could.
Sure.
One question I did want to give you a chance to respond to is he has mailed out material citing a campaign finance violation on your campaign's part in which you withdrew money from your campaign to pay yourself a salary earlier than that could be done. I wanted to ask you a couple questions about that. First mm-hmm. of all, just very simply, have you repaid that money? Has the campaign been reimbursed for that money?
Yes, and okay. there was coverage of that in the paper. I repaid the money as soon as the FEC notified us of the problem.
Okay, and then I think, and again briefly, if you could, because we only have a few minutes left, but candidates drawing salaries out of the money that's raised in campaigns, it's a common practice. but I think it's little known oftentimes to voters. Just in under a minute, could you explain mm-hmm. that system?
Sure. I think it is little known, and we should talk about it more. Under FEC guidelines, candidates are permitted to draw salaries from their campaigns, and there's a really simple reason. Most people cannot afford to not have a job for a year and a half, and that's how long campaigns are now. So what happened previously, before that rule was instituted, is only really rich people could run for office because they were the ones who could afford to stop working for 18 months. And that's why, if you look at Congress, you see that more than half of Congress is made up of millionaires, which is not reflective of the country at large. And so if we want our representatives to look like us, we've got to ensure that everyday folks can run for office. And that's why the FEC instituted the rule that allows candidates to draw salary. It's critically important to diversifying our representation.
So literally a minute left. I think we'll continue this conversation in an online format after we end the broadcast version here. But my last question for the broadcast version, and again, very quickly here, but Francis Canola is suggesting that because this is now on your record, it'll make it easier for John Katko to defeat you, so therefore the Democrats should support him in the primary. In 30 seconds, what's your response to that?
Well, I think he's just wrong. I mean, what we showed in the last race is how tough a competitor I am. John Katko said on election night, I really hope she doesn't run again, because he knows that I'm coming for him and that I'm going to win. He knows how vulnerable he is. And we have in my campaign everything that it takes to win: a massive number of volunteers, more than 1,900 across the district, record-breaking campaign. And the people of the district know me. They know what I'm fighting for. They know that I'm on their side. And that's why the only publicly released poll in this race has shown me with a 43-point lead over my opponent.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Democratic congressional candidate Dana Balter. She's running in the 24th District and hoping to challenge Congressman John Katko in November. So I just had a couple other questions for you, Dana, about the primary first, and again, your opponent there, Francis Canole. We talked at the end of the broadcast version about some of the claims that he's been making regarding you and your campaign and how, from his point of view, they would play out in the general election. I wanted just to continue in that theme with a couple of other questions. Mr. Canole is also emphasizing that he's been endorsed by the Onondaga County Democratic Party and other local parties that, again, according to his mailers, represent 83% of the Democratic voters. And last time, you had a lot of that backing, as I recall. So why should voters not be paying attention to that this time when they're making their decision?
Well, I think voters should obviously take into account whatever is important to them in making their decisions. It's fine to talk about endorsements. I have more endorsements than Mr. Canole does. I have a larger coalition of national support, for example, which is critically important in winning a race like this. But I've also been endorsed by local Democrats. The Oswego County Committee endorsed me. I have the endorsements of more than two dozen local elected officials from all across the district, including State Senator Rachel May, who is the highest ranking Democrat in our district. And I think, those things are valuable to talk about, but what matters ultimately is the vote on election day. And I think that is not about collecting endorsements, that's about connecting with voters and making sure that you show up in every part of the district and listen to people and engage with them and talk to them about the things that matter. That's something that I have been doing for the last 3 years in every corner of this district. And that's how I built the tremendous support that I had in the last campaign, where you may remember I won the primary by 25 points. That connection and that grassroots movement that we've built is why I have a 43-point lead in this primary. And that, by the way, is why you're seeing my opponent attack me, because he knows that without that, he doesn't stand a chance. He can't win by making a case for himself only. And it's unfortunate. I think that Democratic voters, I think voters across the board deserve better than that. I will point out that, the mailer you're talking about, where he talks about endorsements, that mailer was fact-checked by the Auburn Citizen and found to be false. Not only is he making an argument that's sort of besides the point, but he is lying in order to do it. And that, I think, is really a sad thing. And I believe voters deserve better.
The misinformation that you're referring to is, if I have this correct, regarding claims about organizations that have sort of quote unquote refused to endorse you. That was what I believe the Auburn paper fact checked and found in error. Is that correct?
Yes. His claim that
Okay.
organizations refuse to endorse me, and why he attributed motive to a refusal to endorse that
Okay.
actually didn't exist.
So this question is a bit in the weeds. I don't want to take too much time with it, but I think again, it's sort of in the same vein as the issue of taking money as salary out of a campaign, and you explain that, I think, well in the broadcast. But it's another one of these details about how the process works. I think it might help voters to know how these party endorsement decisions get made. And I'll just tell you what I have been told by a couple of Democratic insiders about this, that a lot of this process is about getting friends and even extended family members onto these party committees in order to vote to endorse a particular candidate, and that essentially everybody does it to some extent. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I think that is a fairly accurate representation of how it works. I would dispute the idea that everybody does it.
Okay.
This is my second run for Congress, and I have not done that. I don't believe that that's the way politics should be done. We in this campaign are building a grassroots movement from the ground up for real change that is organically driven by what people in the community want. I am not a fan of the kind of politics that is based on who you know and what your family name is and how prominent you are. I believe in a kind of politics that comes out of community need and community connection, where we all come together to drive change that's going to make the community better for everybody. And it's a different approach. And I think one of the challenges in running a real grassroots campaign is that you come up against a lot of institutions that, parties are only one of the institutions at play in electoral politics. You come up against a lot of institutions that are really based in the old way of doing politics, which is a lot of backroom dealing and a lot of, who you know and what your name is, instead of what do you stand for? How committed are you to doing the hard work of getting this done? how good are you at building a broad base of support and making connections across the community? How well do you understand the issues that are at play? Do you have real ideas about how to solve our community's problems? And how are you going to go about getting that work done? Those are the things that I think should matter. To be honest with you, from my conversations with voters all across the district, and this is true whether I'm talking to Democrats or Republicans or people who are unaffiliated or anything in between, the vast majority of voters that I've talked to feel the same way. They're sick and tired of the kind of politics that's driven by money and connections. And they're really looking for something that is more authentic to the people. So, we're trying really hard to sort of carve a new path here and show that if we do politics that way, we can be successful. And we know that ultimately that will be better for the community and for political outcomes.
So here's my last question. And again, I'm bringing it back to your opponent in the primary. But Mr. Knoll, and he did this during my conversation with him back in March, but it's also clear from all of his campaign communication that this is a major theme, if not the major theme. But he is heavily playing up his prior military service. Do you think that in and of itself is a qualification for political office? How important is that?
By itself, no. I don't think that alone qualifies you, nor do I think it disqualifies you. You know, what I think it does is it demonstrates that Francis Knoll is a dedicated public servant. He has devoted his career to service of this country in a very specific way that I think takes a lot of courage. And I am grateful to him for that. And I honor that. I don't think that makes him any more qualified to serve as a congressperson than someone who's been a teacher their whole lives, or someone who's a nurse or a firefighter or a business owner. The idea of democratic representation is that anybody can serve in office. And what we're trying to achieve in Congress is a Congress that looks like America. That's how we can get good representation, where everybody, every segment of society has their interests represented and their needs met. And that's why we need a lot more women in Congress, because right now only 24% of Congress is women and 51% of the population is women. So we've got a long way to go in terms of representation. We need more people of color. We need far fewer wealthy people in Congress who are way overrepresented. And that's why candidates being able to take a salary matters. We need people from all walks of life there. And everybody who comes with their own experience brings their own perspective, right? All the things that they've learned and done through their lives, they bring to bear on the decisions that they make. And I am bringing a background that I think is very valuable and currently underrepresented in Congress. I think we need more teachers. I think that's good not only for making good policy, but it's also good for engaging the public in democratic representation and opening up government for participation to all of the people that you represent. I think we need more people who have real understanding of policy, and I'm bringing years of study to the table. In being able to look at really complex public policy problems across a broad range of issues and analyze those problems and evaluate potential solutions to those problems. All of that is valuable insight and experience that comes to bear on how you do this job. And again, I think is a big part of why I've been able to connect with voters and why I have so much support in this community.
So once again, that was Dana Balter. And also, once again, the Democratic primary is June 23rd. But you can vote early, and you can also vote by mail. Dana, I want to thank you again for making the extra time to talk with me.
Thanks, Grant. It's been great.
You've been listening again to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.